Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rap Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
I'm a little distraught.
Distraught? Distracted?
I only seem to get sick on weekdays. I must have a weekend immune system.
I remember there was a, when I was working much more than I am now, which frightens me, I would always get a little worried because it's, oh, I got a day off coming. It's a complete day off coming in about a week and a half. And then like a couple days beforehand, I'd get the scratchy throat and everything. It's like, I'm going to be sick on my day off, aren't I? I am going to be sick on my day off. And it always felt like a waste. I'd rather be sick on a work day because then I, you know, you take the day off and you don't feel bad because it's, I'm just going to lay here and be sick. But when it's your day off, I would go, I am wasting a day off by being sick and sleeping all the time.
It's like crushing cans all day. Soda pressing.
Now, I don't know if I told this story or not. When I worked at the movie theater, it was hard to call in sick because they, you know, you're part-time, it's minimum wage, and they treat you like crap. And when the, when the 2000, I think it was 9 or 2010 flu went around, right after the Comic-Con, I felt terrible. So I called in and said, I'm not going to be able to work today. I'm running a fever. I'm not feeling good. And I got one of the 19-year-olds who were like, nope, you need to come in. Too many people have called in sick. You're going to need to come in because we desperately need you. And when I got there, I told him, I cannot work in concessions. I'm running a fever. And they argued with me a bit, and I said, do you want to get everybody who comes in here sick with me handling food? I'm running a fever. I have a fever of 101. Finally, they said, all right, fine. You could be the ticket taker, which is a boring job. You stand there, and as people come in, you check to make sure they have a ticket, and you rip it in half. So I was doing that, and just I don't remember much of anything. And after I'd been there about an hour, the manager came in and took one look at me and came over and said, why the hell are you here? Because I tried to call in sick and they told me that I had to be in. She said, you look like you're dying. Go home.
Yeah.
And I do not remember the next 2 days at all, other than because I kind of crashed on the couch. And would wake up and drink Gatorade so that I didn't get dehydrated and go back to sleep. And I didn't have medical coverage, so I couldn't go to the doctor. The only thing I remember is in my dreams, I had the TV on and the story of the little boy who supposedly was up in the balloon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That seeped into my dreams. So I would wake up every so often. There's that footage of the balloon. And they said, we're trying to bring the balloon down because the little boy's in it. And finally, at the end of it, it was like, oh, he was in the attic all along.
He was in the attic all the time.
And then like a day or two later, it's like, oh, we found out it's a publicity stunt by the parents. They knew he wasn't in the balloon. That whole thing, just I dreamed it. Because I was in and out of consciousness and sick as a dog.
Dream of balloon boy. I've had that on times, not necessarily sick, but just like sleep deprived. Like when Dana was an itty bitty baby and she was very fussy, real fussy to the point where it was real tough to put her down to sleep because she'd always wake up crying. So I took it upon myself.
Is she still like that?
You'd have to ask her boyfriend.
Okay.
But I used to hold her and that would let Chris get some very valuable sleep. And then the caveat is that at 6 o'clock, I'd have to hand her over so I could get like 5 hours of sleep. And then I would go to the shop, get home at 8, rinse, lather, repeat. But I just had a I had her in my arms, and I think I had the Twins game on, and as I kind of drifted in and out of consciousness, I dreamt I was in the outfield of the Dome Stadium holding my baby. And and then I was like, and that's the end of the game. And I'm like, no, no, you got to keep the game going. I got to stay up all night. So what helped and what we should have done in the first place, we got a swing because she would sleep in her swing. But we got one that cranked up. So every 45 minutes, it would stop. She'd cry. And then I'd have to crank it up again. We should have just got one of the electronic ones that just kept the rhythm going. There were actually times when I would go get the books. And at the time, we were picking up our comics at Northwest Cargo, you know, because it's that time where everybody's racing to get their books out first. So I would bring Dana with me, and usually she'd fall asleep in the car. So we'd get out there, and I'd usually, the only other person I'd run into would be like Brian Messick, because he'd be getting the books as well. And we're just waiting, and Dana would just sleep all quiet, like in the car. I'd drop the books off at the shop, and then I'd go home. And then, you know, when I passed off the books, then I'd get to the shop and work on them. Things to do.
Now, I remember when my son was small and my future ex-wife had one of her friends who also had a baby, you know, they're around the same age, move in. And I was working at the group home and at Schindler's. And it was one of those weekends where I went to work Friday morning at Schindler's. When I got done with that, I had to go to the group home, and I was there till Sunday morning, but the Sunday morning staff did not show. So I had to stay there until somebody showed up, and they didn't show up till around 5 in the afternoon. So I had been away from home from Friday morning to Sunday afternoon at work the whole time. And I got home, and both the future ex-wife and her friend were like, oh, goodness, you're here. Good. You can take care of the kids. We're leaving. And I was just exhausted. I sit down on the couch, and the two kids come over, and they're crawling all over me. And they're in the bathroom getting ready, and the doorbell rings. And I just very kind of leaned back and went, oh, God, please let that be a maniac with a knife. It wasn't, though.
Darn.
But that's not what we're here to talk about.
No. If you happen to be a maniac with a knife, you know.
I don't want you to show up anymore. I'm past that stage.
Well, unless you want to come and talk comic books. We don't want you to bring your knife because we don't want them damaged. Right. Because if they get damaged, how in the hell would we get to slab them and get a high grade?
Right. They're not worth as much.
They're worthless.
Even without a maniac with a knife, I've learned a new term,
which is
on the Facebooks, raw.
Raw.
Anybody got any raw keys?
Yeah, raw keys. Yeah. Is that how you do it? You just say, yeah, I want your raw keys. I just want to screw you over so I can take them and slab them and flip them and have some fun. That's almost as crazy as that. They call them. Yeah, I don't know if I want to collect floppies. I'll collect the books instead. I tell you, you kids and your raw keys and your floppies, you just don't know what Corey and I had to go through when we were trying to buy and grade books.
Yeah, we just called them comics.
Yeah. Now, when you bought a book, did you care? Was condition a big thing for you?
It depended. There was some stuff that I wanted in good condition, but I was never what we used to call a Mylar Snuggie. Which is somebody who, I'm sorry, there's a slight line on the spine. This is no longer mint. It is, at best, it's fine. And when I worked at Schindler's, people would argue grade constantly. I was never somebody who argued grade unless a book was expensive, because I wasn't buying for collector purposes. I wanted to read the story. Now, when I worked at Schindler's, there were times that I did buy and flip books. Batman, Death in the Family. I knew that was going to be red hot. Knew it was going to be hot. So I pre-ordered 25 of each issue. And then about 4 months later, sold them to a different shop, and that paid for Christmas. And I was happy that I'd done it. I also bought 25 issues of Wonder Man number one because I thought Geoff Johnson was going to be the biggest hot artist around. That didn't pay for anything. Although Geoff Johnson still draw comics, still his stuff's still amazing, still really good. Can't understand why he wasn't a hotter artist than he was. But I was never somebody who demanded that sort of grading for myself. Now, when I helped comic shops before I worked at Schindler's, then when I worked at Schindler's, and then when I worked for you, I knew how to grade. And I was, Schindler's really liked me because I was an incredibly strict grader. And what I would do, I would have the Overstreet there and I would look over a book and I would flip through it and, you know, see how glossy the cover was and try to figure out how white the pages were and go by strict Overstreet, which they loved until the Overstreet grading guide came out. And I think I've told this story. The Overstreet grading guide, I think it came out in either 89 or 90. Might have even been 91. I'm not 100% sure, but it was in that time period. And I ordered one, and remember, it came with a card, and you would take the card, and it would, you know, this is a, you know, the white page. You could hold it against the page to see where the yellowing was on the chart, and they would have picture examples of everything, and Schindler's had it on the shelf, and then the next day, we were called, and we were told, pull them all. We're not going to be going by that, and we don't want our customers going by that. Because Overstreet graded much stricter than Schindler's, which meant that all of Schindler's books weren't worth as much. So, no, we got to get rid of that. But when I was selling a book, I did everything I could to make sure that I graded as strict as possible. Now, you as a dealer probably had to be on that wavelength as well when you were selling books. Were you on that wavelength when you were buying them?
Pretty much. I mean, it was always, because what happened was, is remember, Pat and I would buy books before we had a shop together. And what I did find is a phenomena where, you know, if I was buying for myself, you know, condition was everything. You know, even for guys overgraded, nobody changed the price. That's good. It is what it is. And then, of course, when they come by to me, they're like, oh, you overgraded this. And I'm like, well, it's better than the one I tried to buy from you. So, again, depending on the dealer, there were some that, you know, thought they were hot shit when it came to grading. There were others that didn't. And you had to decide, did you want to just buy from this guy? Because there were a couple of times I remember buying the, I think it was Doctor Strange, Master of Mystic Arts 5 and 6. He had them priced near mint, but I wanted to read them, so I probably overpaid for them, even though when I got them home, they were probably fine at best. Maybe even fine less, because they were, you know, a lot of crinkles on it. And you're like, I just wanted to read it, because I was so into it. Even after, that was that number 3? Was that the one where they filled in the reprint? Which to me was just, I thought they did that just because they were trying to get us ready for the next issue. I had no idea about the dreaded deadline doom, because they put that header before and after, you know, where Doctor Strange was like, oh, I remember back when. Fooled me that time. So there was always that interesting thing, because, you know, dealing with other dealers, you know, their grading was God's word and mine was shit, you know. So as time went on, I became less and less concerned about it, to be truthful. I mean, I graded what I graded. I think I'm a hard grader. There were even times where, like, some guy come in and he was trying to sell a Superboy to me, and I had a big chunk out of the corner, and he thought it was near mint. And I'm like, oh, it's a nice book, but this chunk keeps it from being near mint. I would put it maybe at a fine or very good. And then the next dealer he started to bought it because – you know, they're like, whatever, chunks out of it. They didn't care. So even as the shop went on, I guess, you know, I would grade things accordingly. What really threw everybody off is I can't remember. I think this had to have been in the early 80s. Overstreet did a big adjustment in their price guide.
Yes.
That used to be, yeah, like a near mint would go up and it would drag all the other prices up. And then somewhere along the way, he realized, you know, there are more good, very good, fine copies of this book than there are near mint. So near mint stayed high and everything else dropped. And people lost their minds. Suddenly, you know, if a near mint was $3,000 and a fine was $2,000, well, no, a fine ended up dropping to like $1,500, maybe $1,000. Oh, no, that's not fair. That's not the way it is. Like, well, that was the thing with Golden Age, Silver Age. People read them, even into the 80s. People read the books. They didn't collect them, you know, oh, I got my picture perfect. Now, as a buyer, I remember doing that. Although if I really wanted the book, I would buy it off the shelf. And of course, being younger, I was too naive to say, hey, could you like get a discount because it's beat up? And 90% of the time they wouldn't do it. A few times you'd run into someone who would go, oh yeah, I see what you mean. It's ripped. Yeah. Cause they looked at it like, well, if I give this kid a 10% discount, it beats trying to return it as damaged. I know when I got books in from Diamond, if they were really beat up, I would put them in a pile and, you know, send them in for credit. I'm sure that was nickel and diming Diamond to death, but it's just a fact of the matter. You send me a bunch of damaged comics, I cannot sell them on the shelf. You know, even
now,
today.
There is a rumor about that, by the way.
Okay.
I will not say the shop.
Oh, I would. Unless they're still around.
But there was a shop who, if they ordered too many of a book, they would actually take the book and crack it on the counter. Oh, it's damaged. Got to call Diamond. And they would return them as being damaged, even though they're the ones who damaged them. And now you know why I won't name what shop it was that was rumored to have done this. They were also one of those shops that was very much... they catered to the, I'm just going to call them the Mylar Snuggies, the people who would go to the shelf and look over for the most mint copy on the shelf to buy. And you had a few of those guys, too.
Oh, yeah.
You'd hand them their books, and then they'd go to the shelf to see if they could find a better copy.
Which I didn't mind. There were a few guys, what they would do is they'd, like, grab the entire pile of books. And I would be like, you know, if there's no one in the store, that's fine. But don't hoard an entire pile of books, especially if somebody else is waiting for one. You know, the ones you read, you just put on the shelf. But, you know, you can't do that. So, yep. And, you know, they got the message. And worse would come is when you had, like, say you ordered a single copy for that person. So, well, I don't like the grade. It's like, well, that's fine, but I can't get another one. You know, especially if you're talking independence and things like that. I used to get people that way with toys, too. You know, they're like, do you got anything better? I'm like, are you buying? You know, people would buy for the blister, for the card, and for the toy inside it. And I'd tell them, dude, I'm selling the toy. I'm not selling it as a collector item. See those vintage DC Superpowers and Marvel Secret Wars? Those I'm selling as collector items. So there the card and things like that matter. But generally, for the most part, I think I did fine in terms of grading as a dealer and as a retailer. And if I didn't, I'd be like, you know, come back when I was doing one of my 70% off sales. There's a chance to get it cheaper. Now, I think I railed about it last podcast. But the one thing that's kind of disappeared is the idea that, oh, I can take the book and press out the wrinkles and maybe cut the corners and make it look a lot better. That used to be verboten when I was a collector. Even Gruber to this day, I don't know if he softened, but I told him, I said, you know, remember that thing that the one guy we bought from, you know, he restored his book. So when Pat went in to get it graded, it came back with a purple heading. This book has been restored. And I was telling Pat, you know, nowadays, that's considered normal, whereas for you and I, that was the kiss of death on a book, because a restored book would sell at fine even if it looked near mint. And you had people that could tell this, but that seemed to have gone the way of, I don't know, Secret Wars 2.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. But also I remember in the 80s, not as much in the 70s, but in the 80s, they had people who would restore Golden Age books, and they would show a picture of one. It would be missing chunks, et cetera, et cetera. And they could actually match paper and do all of that. And it would come with a certificate so that when you sold it, you weren't lying to whoever you sold it to. Now, before that, there were, in the 70s, it was almost kind of the Wild West. Because I remember when I first became serious about comics, and you start, okay, I'm going to buy back issues through the mail, you would learn really quickly who you could trust and who you couldn't. Because there were some dealers who would say, oh, this is a near mint book, and you'd get it, and it would be good at best. And people would get furious. I remember getting my first comic buyer's guide back, I think it was like 82. And there would, it was still, you know, it had been sold to Donna Maggie Thompson, but it was still primarily for collectors to sell to each other. And there were a lot of letters who, well, I ordered from this dealer and they shipped me this and they said it was near mint and it was really only fine. And I think that, you know, there should be an investigation into their grading practices, et cetera, et cetera. And in the 70s, you would see, you know, bookstores would restore books and they would also restore your comics. To the point where they would run ads, hey, do you have, you know, this comic all beat to hell? You can send it in and we can restore it, or we'll buy it from you so that we can use it to restore other books. So there was, and it's hard to remember, but grading in Overstreet in the 70s was very vague. It wasn't until the 80s that they started to get very nitpicky about the grading. And the, like I said, it wasn't until they came out with the Overstreet Guide to Grading that it was really kind of this, okay, we're all agreeing on that. And it was a few years after that that we did get CGC. And I think they, weren't they the first people who would slab a comic? You would send it in.
Yeah.
They would grade it, seal it in inert plastic. That was the big thing. It can't be plastic that's going to degrade, because then, you know, the plastic will leach into the book. And you would send it in and get it back, and it would be graded. And those would sell for more because they were at that point an investment.
Yeah. The other thing, too, when you compare that with what Overstreet says, I often find this, especially in my eBay dealings, I'll send something off and people will be like, why, this book isn't near mint. And I'm like, well, yes, it is, because near mint goes from, like, I forget what the numbers are, like 8.1 to 9.2 or something. And, you know, people are always thinking near mint, like, oh, it's perfect. I said, well, if it was perfect, I wouldn't have sold it to you. I would have graded it and retired on it years ago. So, and I got to tell you, I have, for the most part, was against grading. Now, I know where CGC came from. They came from the baseball field, and as they announced they were doing this for comics, again, there was a wailing and gnashing of teeth. They're saying, oh, no, they're going to ruin the market because, you know, people are going to have their favorites that are going to get high grades, and people aren't going to get low grades, and people are going to get upset, and all these weird reasons. For me, it was more fundamental, because if you grade a baseball card, you can still look at it and enjoy it. If you grade a comic book, you can't read it. What's the point of grading it if you can't read it? There were dealers in the price guides when Overstreet did, what was it called? Was it Fan?
Yes.
Or Overstreet Marketplace, whatever it was.
It was called Overstreet Fan.
These,
comic book marketplace,
well, there was one that was more of a
magazine.
Yeah. There was one that was more of a marketplace thing. And what it was is there was a guy who only dealt in 9.8 comics. And I was, yeah, that was really confused. Yeah, how? What do you do to get a 9.8 comic? Do you say you send this batch of comics into CGC and say, only grade them if they're 9.8? And then he would get back a pile of 9.8s, but that's all he did. I mean, I never asked him. I didn't really care. But I thought that was kind of salty. And then, of course, when people ended up with a 10, that was like mana from heaven, because you could sky's the limit, because it's certified you have a perfect comic. So I started to get into the idea. It's like, okay, yeah, I can understand people wanting that. I don't personally want it, because I think comics are meant to be read. But I could see two things. First of all, you may not like my pricing or my grading, and I might not like yours. But we really can't argue if CGC says it's 5.0. They say very openly how they do it. It's not one person grading it, it's several. And I think it's still that way now. I don't know what they do now. Could just be one guy. 8, 10, 7.4. But I don't again, I'm being cynical, and I'll tell you why momentarily. But this time, if I sell you a book and it's 9.8 and you don't agree, it's like, well, argue with CGC. This is it. So young Cray in the tail end of his comic shop decides, you know what? I think I'll send in some stuff and get on this gravy thing. So I go through, and I got to tell you, finding what you would think is a mint comic, even in your newsstand comics right off the shelf, was tough, because you would see little printer flaws or little dings or little scratches. Maybe there'd be something inside, because CGC says they go through the entire book. So out of an entire shipment once, I found like maybe four comics I thought would be worthy to send in. So I sent them in. Not one of them came back above an 8.0. And I thought, well, this is a fucking scam. You know, the best of the best out of my shipment, and it's not the best to them. And I might even showed you, Corey, or I might have showed somebody and said, you tell me. Where, you know, the problem was, is they sent it back and they didn't tell you what the flaw was. Why isn't this a 9.8 or at least a very mint, near mint? And I thought, you know what, for the price I'm paying, it's not worth it. It's just like gambling. You know, I don't know how this guy, you know, Overstreet does nothing but 9.8s, and I can't even, out of the best of the best, and even, you know, Mike's agreed with me when we sent him in, all I could get was an 8.0. And then CGC did something. Well, they did something different. I don't want to get into that yet, but I'm just curious, Corey, what you thought of that, or if you even bothered to slab anything in your collecting years.
I have not sent anything in to get slabbed. I have bought a couple of slabbed books here and there. And the reason is not because it's a comic I want. It is a comic I am investing in. And I think because I am involved in all of these groups about older comics, on the Timely Atlas group, they used to be very proud of the fact that they would liberate old Timely Atlas books because they were collectors. They were readers. They weren't collectors. And they wanted to read the old stuff. And most of the old stuff would get slabbed. And they would, okay, I got battle number 3. I cracked that baby open so I could read it. And they were really proud of that. And there is a part of me that, especially in the 90s, completely understands that. But now, a good 80% of Marvel Timely Atlas's output is available digitally. So for battle number 3, I can go to Marvel's website right this minute and buy it for $1.99. I don't need to haunt eBay or go to comic shops, et cetera, et cetera. If I want to read it, right there. Or I could just Marvel Unlimited. There you go. Read it as part of my subscription. But if I find one that is in decent shape, there aren't going to be many of those. there are collectors who are looking to fill holes in collections still, not as many as there used to be. And it's 70 years old. So a book like that, if I'm going to buy it, I'm going to buy it either to slab or already slabbed, because it's an investment. And there's very little that I buy off the shelf that I think, oh, this is going to be worth money, because I don't think that way anymore. But if I was investing in books, damn right I would slab them, because then when you sell them, you don't have to argue about grade. You don't have to worry about the person, like you said, who gets it in the mail and says, oh, you said this was a 9.5, and I'm sorry, it's an 8.7.
Yeah.
Nope, it's labeled. They do it with baseball cards. And the reason they do it with baseball cards is because there are very, very few people who just want to have the baseball card. They're all investments, unless you're a little kid.
Yeah. And I see that now, like you said, when guys are looking for raw books to flip, you know, and we'll talk a bit about that in the flipper. The other thing that CGC did as time went on is it used to be they've set a flat fee for slabbing certain books. So even if I had a book slabbed, a minimum was $15. And in the case of like the Captain Americas, I don't know what I did with that. I do recall selling, I think it was a gold. My brain's losing. But it was a gold variant cover of a Superman. Might have been an action annual, you know, where he's trying to hold back the globe of the Daily Planet and people in front of him are running and things like that. And it was really printed poorly, so you were lucky to get anything above an 8. And when I sold it in that shape, it was probably, I would have made back what I paid to have it graded, you know, which would have been like $30. But then CGC changed their guidelines. So if you put in a comic that's probably going to go for thousands of dollars, they took a percentage of it. And there was howling on that again. And then the baseball card guys just kind of laughed at him and said, well, yeah, that's what they do with us. Set in a Mickey Mantle rookie card and it's going to sell for $1 million. Yeah, they're going to take a big chunk of it off. Not enough that you're not going to make money. So you always got to be careful when you send something in, especially if you're sending in a key book, because you're going to probably pay CGC a little. They get a little taste of the action. And certainly hasn't
they get
slowed
to wet their beak a little.
It doesn't slow it down. I also believe if you're a member, I don't know if you can just do this by looking or if you have to be a member, but you can look and see how many you have that are like spawn number one. I believe there's one or two that have been graded 10. And of those, neither of them have ever showed up at auction. Because CGC tracks how many there are. And this can be valuable, especially like you said, you start talking EC books and older books where you might, the best known one might only be a 7.0. Because you can go on CGC's website and discover it. Well, yeah, everything else is graded low. You've got the top one. Therefore, you could probably command a little higher price. And between that information, I find that would be a lot of fun to just track. I mean, not only to discover, you know, are there any 10s out there? And I haven't heard of a 10 popping up in ages. But then again, you know, I don't go through every single site. Because it used to be a 10 would pop up and it like lit up the webs. But you can also go and say, okay, well, what is the highest graded price of, I don't know, action number one or Amazing Spider-Man number one, things like that. I can't help but think of a guy, and I can't remember his name, but he was one of the guys from a Middle Eastern country who was absorbing all the key high grades that ever popped up in auction. And finally, this guy came forward and said, it's my collection. And he started touring the world with it pre-COVID. you know, the best of the best, everything slabbed, everything ready to look at. So you want to know who this guy was who was buying the $1.5 million copy of Detective Number One? It was him. And again, with COVID, I think he might have brought the collection back, waiting for things to settle down. So again, a lot of different fun things you can do once you've graded a book. You can actually, is yours the best? I also think it's easier to handle. There are boxes now you can buy that you can put your CGC in. That said, I don't, right now the big thing that seems to be with everybody, everybody wants to flip the book. You know, the biggest example that came out, and rightly so, was the signed Todd McFarlane that came out when he did Gunslinger Spawn and King Spawn and Spawn Universe. Because you could buy a raw copy, to use the term, for maybe $800 to $900. Or these people could slab it, and they were going, starting at $1,800 and going up. I haven't even looked to see what they're going yet, because I would suspect 99% of these comics were slapped. Not only for flipping and for guide purposes, but also for one of two things that I actually think CGC is good for. And one of them is their signature authenticity program. I haven't heard a lot of, how would you say, counterfeit signatures in the comic book markets?
Yeah, mostly because signatures on a comic doesn't make it worth more for the most part.
It does.
There are places where, like Dynamic Forces has made an entire publishing empire out of the, okay, this has been signed by this creator, and here's your certificate of authenticity, and we will get you a CGC version.
I would agree with you.
But here in the Twin Cities, Joe, if you want an autographed Death of Superman, Superman number 75, I imagine it's easier to get one that's autographed than not autographed, because Dan Jurgens has been signing them for 30 years.
Yeah, but you'd be wrong. They're not around.
Signed comics, see them all the time.
Yeah, you see them, but they're just not around. You can't go to a comic store and say, I need one. You could probably call Dan Jurgens and get one. No, you're wrong about the signed books. Signed books do have a value. Granted, the Dan Jurgens example is the old adage, the prophet is well regarded everywhere except his hometown. However, not every signature is created equal. Again, a lot of demand in it. You should see the pop up in price for George Perez signatures when he announced he had pancreatic cancer. It's a very ghoulish part of the market. Yeah, it's gone down again because there are a lot of them out there. Stan Lee's autograph went up. It's not coming down.
I remember a time
to get a Jack Kirby autograph.
Yeah, I remember a time when a Stan Lee autograph, nobody would pay extra for it because Stan signed everything. He would sign DC books. He would sign Archie books. He would sign anything you put in front of him. And it was, it's just a Stan Lee signature. But now the ghoulish line is he's not making them anymore.
Yeah. And it also depends on, let's just say there's a few guys like Greg Horn and Joe Jusko and even Peter Campbell and even Pat Gleason. They sign books in their own website and sell them, and they sell out phenomenally fast. Oftentimes, they're variants of, like, I think I've got one of the Virgin Webhead covers, number 55, Amazing Spider-Man, that came out. And I just recently, I think I talked about it last podcast, got some from the She-Hulk. I got this from Joe Jusko. And you pay a premium for it. But they're variants that he has himself. The key with a lot of these, I don't think there are many counterfeits around, like I said before. That seems to be more prevalent in the sports merchandise market. It might happen. But like you said, there are so many Stanleys out there. If you get something where it says, like even the, what was the book I bought recently, the Spectacular Spider-Man with a Sal Buscema autograph. And I want to see what one looks like. Well, I can just go online and find and look around. I'm looking right now at a where'd you go? Don't be shy. Dude. Sorry. Keep my gay reflex going. This is a Deathmate tour book. Signed, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different signatures. I recognize Rob Liefeld. I recognize Jim Lee. I can't read the other ones. However, I can go online and compare it to a Jim Lee. I know what a Rob Liefeld signature looks like. And, yeah, if someone wants to fake one out, what's the point? But you can – another tough one was somewhere I have a Sirens number one when they had a release party. And there's 30 people that signed it. I can barely make out George Perez's autograph. I have no idea who the other 29 people are. Because it didn't come with a certificate. And it didn't say, hey, these are the ones who signed it. You know, I used to have an Ultimate Warrior one signed. All I have is a picture of me shaking his hand. I don't have a certificate saying it's actually his. So, and even then, a certificate doesn't really mean anything other than, you know, yeah, you want to go sue the person who came out with a certificate that said, hey, this is guaranteed, only to find out later, I didn't sign that, and it was fake. But with the signature authenticity that CGC has, that gives you a secondary reassurance, I guess is the word I'm looking for, reassurance that it is a genuine signature. So that I have I guess that's a good reason to have a CGC. The only problem is that, like with my CC Beck number one, the Shazam one signed, he signed it on the inside cover, which is what a lot of people did in that time in ballpoint pen. Now they use ink on the outside of the cover so you can actually see it. So if you do have it CGC signed, you can still see the signature. You know, I don't know how CGC would do that with CC Beck. Would you like fold the front cover over? Get a lower grade, but you can see the signature. So to you, Corey, if you were hell-bent on buying a signature of an artist, does a certificate of authenticity or like CGC signature authenticity, does that mean anything to you? Would you buy one that had one versus one that didn't?
It would depend. If I'm going to flip it, I want that certificate of authenticity.
Yeah. Oh, good point. Absolutely.
If I'm just buying it because, hey, Jack Kirby signed this book, I could check the signature. I know what Jack Kirby's signature looks like. And believe me, there are a lot of people on the Facebooks and discussion groups that I'm in who will point out, this is Jack's signature, this is not, and this is why. You know, people, you know, there were people who were forging it. They're like, nope, Jack always did this. The forger didn't do that. Or, you know, little things like that. But if I'm buying it to sell it, if I'm buying as an investment, you're damn right I want that certificate, because I don't want the person coming back to me to say, hey, this is forged.
So now waiting in line at a con to get a signature isn't that big a deal to you. I mean, other than you don't go to cons, but if you went to a con.
Even when I went to cons, I would maybe get a signature of somebody I really liked, but most of the time I was just there to shake their hand. Pat Broderick, great example. First day, I just wanted to meet him and thank him, et cetera, et cetera. We chatted for a little bit. And then the next day, I brought him a comic he did not remember doing. I brought Man-Thing Essential. And he said, oh, I didn't draw on any of that. And I flipped to the page and I said, well, could you please sign here where it's, you know, art written by Steve Gerber, art by Pat Broderick. Could you sign on this page? Not on the cover. No, on this page, because you forgot you did this comic. And when I met Don McGregor the first time, yes, I got comics signed. Every other time since, it's just been, hey, good to see you again. And anymore, I can understand wanting that signature to kind of have a something tangible of that moment. But as I've gotten older, I don't need that tangibility of the moment. I will just remember the moment and remember the interaction and make sure that I thank the person for what they did. Because the signature, it's like with Adam Hughes. Talking with Adam Hughes. The only thing I've ever gotten from Adam Hughes that signed is the sketchbook he was selling. They were all pre-signed. Because every time I've chatted with him after the con, he talks about, you know, I like you guys. I like doing cons and stuff. But it feels like the whole time I'm there, I'm just looking at belt buckles.
Yeah.
Because my head is down and I'm signing. My head is down and I'm signing. My head is down and I'm signing. And I understand that. I didn't see it the last few cons I went to, but I remember in the 90s, people would be bringing short boxes of books to get signed. And that's something that kind of put me off getting signatures too, because then you're asking this person to do something for you for free that you are using as an investment.
Yeah. I know some dealers, I think like Tony Isabella, like he charges $5 and then donates it to charity.
Yeah.
To kind of take that sting out because, you know, same thing. He doesn't want to spend all day signing your 1,000 copies of everything he's ever done. You know, and I've actually got mentally pictured guys who would, they'd show up at cons and, you know, you'd be standing in front of them and they'd be taking it out of the board and one sign. And some of the creators would be like, okay, would you step aside? Let me sign some other ones and I'll come back and sign yours. So yeah, there's always somebody pushing it. And I don't even know if this guy was a flipper. I think he just wanted every single comic of his signed by somebody. You know, I did it too when we went to see Neil Gaiman, but back then it wasn't Neil Gaiman. It was just him. But I only brought like 20 copies of Sandman in. And Sandman was just catching hold. He was gracious about signing it. But if he had said, like when we were in line for the Ultimate Warriors, one of the handlers said, okay, he can only sign two things. And I had three things I wanted signed. And I'm like, okay, whatever, just pick two. Because, you know, there's somebody in front of him that had 20 things I wanted signed. And, you know, he wasn't doing it necessarily as a fan. Or maybe he was, I don't know. But the guy only had one freaking comic book out, so at the time. So, again, CGC, signature authenticity, I like. What do you think about the idea of, you know, the flippers, the guys who are buying comics just to grade and flip?
I don't see a problem with that myself because it's a side hustle. And if the market allows for that, then the market allows for that.
And you don't have to buy their comic.
Right. That's the other thing. It's not like in the 80s. Let's talk about how it used to be where people would get so furious at flippers because, the book's out and now it's sold out and these assholes bought 20 copies of it. They're selling it for $5 each and it should, yeah. Well, guess what? If a book sells out 99 times out of 100, they're going to do a second printing so I can read it. Or I can buy it digitally so I can read it. Or it'll be a trade paperback so I can read it. And unless you're a collector, as long as you can read it, you can read it. Now, there are collectors, and they need to know, just like with baseball cards or depression glass or any other collectible, that is a volatile market, as long as there's a market. I remember the Beanie Baby craze, and they made it the special thing so you could snap on to the tab so that the tag remained mint. And, you know, McDonald's is going to have the Beanie Baby Happy Meals. So on Friday, when they would change the toy, you'd see a line of a mile and a half of people waiting in line to get that Happy Meal with that Beanie Baby. If that's what you want to do, if that's what you enjoy, if you take joy out of doing that, of flipping those books, cool. great hobby. Glad you enjoy it. It's not my problem because it's not why I'm into comics. Now, I'll be honest, if I were into comics to make money, it now is a frighteningly easy time. Because all you need to do is go to Box Office Mojo or one of the sites that say they're comic book news and are really just media news. And all right, what TV movie went into production? Oh, this movie went into production. I'm going to go. I'm going to buy all of the first appearances and first issues that I can, send them off to CGC. By the time they come back, they'll be worth 10 times what they were when I bought them. Bingo. Moon Knight, great example. No one gave half a shit about Moon Knight 2 years ago. And if the first appearance was worth anything, it was because, okay, it's 50 years old. He was hot there for a little while. All right. Maybe a $25 to $50 book. Now, there's going to be a TV series. Boom! The prices go insane. Will they stay insane? Don't know. Because I know when they did the Hellstrom TV show, before it came out, first appearance of Son of Satan was worth a lot of money. Now, the TV series came out. It bombed. Nobody watched it. No one cares. But boy, when they were making that TV series, you could make a lot of money. The other thing I would do, if I was in it to make money, hey, I'm going to shops just like John Nunziata did. Anything you have before 1970, I'm buying it. Why? Because those books are 50 to 60 years old. They're not making them anymore. They're collectibles at this point. The ones in good shape are going to be hard to find because everybody read their comics back then. Even the high-grade Marvel stuff, which in the 80s, when I started working at Schindler's, you could pick up for $5-$10. Those are $300, $400 books now. If you know your market, you can do well. I would stay out of the new comics because that market is way too volatile. But there is a way that I could do it. I'm just not that person. I don't care. I'm going to read. Have I invested in a few things? Yep. Am I going to in the future? Maybe. But I'm not going to be one of those people who, I don't care if you slab your books. I'm not going to be, oh, I can't believe that this idiot slabbed his books. No, he slabbed his books because he's going to sell them. But I'm also not going to be a person who, oh, I can't believe that they bought up all the copies off the shelf to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's a hot book. And 6 months from now, I can pick it up 99 times out of 100. Again, I'll be able to pick it up on eBay for cover price in a year or two. Like those Batman number ones from Walmart. There was a time they were going for $50. Guess what? Cover price.
Yeah, no one cares.
Yeah.
Now, there is one thing that I do recommend, and I don't even know if you have something like this, Corey, but I always talk about my number one comic that started me on this, I guess, roller coaster ride, collecting, you know, being a dealer, being a retailer, going to cons, going to San Diego with you, and ultimately this here podcast. You know, my beloved, and I'm looking at it right now. There it is, my Amazing Spider-Man 178. And I got this idea from Bo Smith, who, again, comic writer, the manliest man in comics. Sorry, Bill Tucci, it's just true. And he doesn't like slabbing. He doesn't care, I don't think. But the only thing he slabs are comics that mean something to him, personalized comics. And I have two. The first one, of course, being Amazing Spider-Man 178, and I've talked about the origin stories of this before, but this was the first comic to get me going. And it's graded a mere 5.0, and I don't care, because this means something to me. The other one being, of course, is a Star Wars number 4, which I bought at a newsstand long since gone up in Ely, Minnesota. It reminds me of going up to my grandfather's cabin every summer. This one is a mere 2.0. And they mean something to me. I do have another copy of 178 if I want to read it. I do have it. I think it went that far in the Essential series. If not, I'll certainly buy it when I find the Epic series on it, because this was a memorable storyline for me. I mean, Star Wars, maybe less so. But so to you, Corey, are there any comics that personal that you would slab them just to keep them as is, where you look at them and the memory means more to you than reading it or what the value might be?
Not especially an individual comic. I do have my one EC book that I bought when I discovered EC. It's Tales from the Crypt, number 26. It's all beat to hell. I may get that slabbed at some point because it was the first EC book I got, and I actually stumbled across it at a yard sale of all things. Yep, bought it. 3 for 25 cents. Again, the physical thing doesn't mean as much as the memory does, and the memory is more in my head. If I was to do that, it would be that, what was it? It was Marvel Tales number 59. But they would send it back because the cover's detached, and I literally read it to death.
But you still got it.
I should. Actually, at some point, I should get the books that I have had letters in, or the comics in the 80s that I had some short stories in, and get those slabbed. Because, hey, I'm in this.
Do you still got that Marvel team up? Or 2-in-1?
No, the Marvel Tales.
Tales,
yeah. Yeah, I do. It's see, in that's, a box.
That's brilliant. See, that would be the type of thing I would slab. Because the other thing you can do when it's slabbed like that, you can put it on the wall. You know, you can make a display out of it. So, yeah, that's the only type of fun things I do. Again, I don't begrudge flippers, but it's kind of sad now. One of the books I've been wanting is a Platinum Spider-Man. Never owned one. And the price is going up and up and up. Now the only ones available are slabbed. And, of course, when it's slabbed, that means somebody's asking 3 to 4 times what it guides for. And I'm like, it doesn't mean that much to me. Not slabbed like that. I mean, I at least want to hold it, look at it. But it is bemusing to listen to people flipping. I've actually had people ask me, I said, is it worth flipping? And I said, well, it depends on how much time you want to put into this. I mean, you're going to spend a bit of money to like get a key book slabbed. But if you're looking to invest it, not saying it'll keep its investment, but I'm pretty sure if you got Amazing Spider-Man 1 and you slab it, it's not going to go down.
Right. I think, let's see how much time we have spent on this. Oh, we're a little over an hour.
Oh, you can't slab a podcast.
So kind of to wrap it up.
You mean slab it up?
I'm going to give my advice on slabbing for the people who listen to this podcast. For the most part, there are exceptions, like Joe slabbing the first book he got that got him interested in comics. If you are looking to buy a comic that you will at some point sell on the eBays, which is kind of why slabbing took off, in my opinion, rather than, well, I say it's fine. Well, I say it's in very good and you're full of shit. Huh. Nope. If it's slabbed, there's no arguments. If you're going to be buying books for investing and you're going to be selling them later, you should get them slabbed. They are worth more when they're slabbed automatically. The second thing is, you never have to argue about condition. You won't have a dealer say, I'm going to rate it as very good. And then he'll sell it later at very fine. Or, you know, anything like that. It helps in the transaction. Does it help in the collecting realm? very much so, because it gives an agreed upon commodity. And when you slab a book, you've turned it into a commodity. It's no longer a piece of art or a story or a book you're going to read. It is a commodity, a collectible, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a bad thing? I don't think so. I'm not one of these people who gets mad when a book is slabbed. Oh, now nobody can read it. Well, it's not meant to be read. It's a collectible at this point. If I've got an action number 40, there is no way on this planet I would trust myself to read it. Because not only will the slightest bend make it worth $100 less, but there's no point in reading a book that old when it's available free to read as part of a subscription service, et cetera, et cetera. I would only be buying Superman number 40 as an investment. Now, should you be slabbing tons of books that you buy that are modern? No. Yeah, it's going to be worth more, but most of those books, and we've said this for years, most of those books are going to be sold by the pound, to where I think you and I were talking about it on our last drive around. Local shop showers are given $10 to $15 a long box. That's 300 books for $10. Why? Back issues, unless it's a key book, no one cares. No one's trying to fill in their collections anymore. Joe, what's your wrap up on slabbing?
If you luck out and you find a Spider-Man 800, the unused Jack Kirby cover, yeah, slab it. But I'm online now right now trying to look for the infamous signed Gunslinger Spawn. And I can't find any at the moment. Oh, there's one. $224. Well, I don't think that's signed. That wasn't the signed one. You know, buyer beware. That's really the only thing you can say.
You know where else you should beware, Joe?
Well, you should wear clothes pretty much everywhere you go.
No, beware.
Oh, beware.
You should beware when you're out on the internet, because it's crazy and dangerous out there. Yeah. But our sponsor can help you. Our newest sponsor is NordVPN. Let's be honest, if you're out on the internet, you need a VPN to protect you. There's all sorts of things going on the internet where people can track you. You could accidentally download a keylogger, all sorts of things. NordVPN gives the best security possible. It has a password manager, which generates complex passwords, syncs across all your devices, stores your notes and credit card information. It also gives you 10 gigabytes of private cloud storage, secure files. It backs up your data automatically. But the main thing it gives you is peace of mind. It gives you peace of mind when you're out on the internet, when you're streaming, when you're playing games, when you're listening to podcasts like this one. It gives you safety anywhere at any time. It protects your online activity. You get full access to all content. And if you use the link go.nordvpn.net/3ku, it'll take you to where you can get a great deal for a 1 month plan, a 2 year plan, a 1 year plan. They are our newest sponsor. We're happy to have them. And if you would like to sponsor something here at any of the podcasts on the Solitaire Rose Network, you can. Just email me, solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. And you should also be aware, not beware, but be aware. I do all these other podcasts. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network is currently on a pause, basically because COVID-19 has made it so that I have to work a lot of extra hours at both jobs. But you can still go and listen to my other podcasts. Now, you're probably listening to Crazy Comics and Stories, which is the main podcast. But on this same feed, KRAYZCOMIX, is Solitaire Rose Radio, the solo radio podcast that I do. I've done interviews, I've done short stories, I've done all sorts of things, and you can get to it right here on this same feed. I also do a podcast called Novelcast, where I take the novels I've written and turn them into free audiobooks. That's over at novels.solitairerose.com. Dangerous Dan Moore and I, and of course Wolfie B. Bad, give you bad advice over at badadvice.solitairerose.com. You send in your questions, and we give you the aforementioned bad advice. And then myself and Adam Vermillion from For the Love of Comics do the Fantastic Forecast at fantasticforecast.solitairerose.com, where we go through the issues of the Fantastic Four, four issues at a time, to give the plot and commentary on each issue. That's not all. Yes, I'm crazy. I still, over at PWInsiderElite.com, every week on Wednesday, do a recap of the latest episode of AEW Dynamite. I write up what happened, and then myself and Anthony Pyrus will do an audio. Now, you can only listen to the audio if you're a member at PWInsiderElite.com, and if you're a wrestling fan, you should be, where we then break down the episode, talk about what we liked, what we didn't like, give it a grade, and let you know if you should have watched that episode. Those are the other podcasts here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network. Thanks. We now get to Joe's favorite part of the show. No. Not where I go into detail about the series Crusaders from DC Comics in 1992. Can you tell that I'm flipping through my Overstreet Press Guide to Lost Universes? Yeah, pretty much. No, it's Joe. What's going on the eBays?
Oh, I found some of those signed spawned ones. They're still hovering around $1,000. So if you paid like $800 for it, forget about it. Oh, I've been selling all sorts of stuff. Speaking of signed things, this is one of those books from CGC or from Dynamic Forces. James Bond, Agent of Spectre, number one. This is an Atlas edition signed by Christos Gage, who I believe was the he was the writer. And guess what it went for, Corey? CGC certificate and everything.
I would have no idea.
I said guess. I didn't say did you know.
At $50.
$12.99.
Oh.
Yeah. So again, not every signature is created equal. Some other fun things I sold. Bob Burger's number one, Baltimore Comic Con exclusive. A guy contacted me, said, "Hey, will you take this?" And I said, "Sure." I had a Lady McKenna, the Monster of the Ministry of Hell, number two, one of the black and white variant covers. That's the current series that's out now. An older one, when Stan Lee passed away. I'm sorry, when Stan Kirby passed away, Marvel Spotlight did a spotlight featuring Stan Lee with a tribute to Jack Kirby inside it. Very cool articles, things like that. I had a copy of it. It's sold. I think we've talked about this book in the past. Baby, You're Really Something, which is from Eros Comics, which features good girl art from Frank Frazetta. It's a one-shot, not an adult book, because there's no boobies, bare boobies in it. I know when I had it originally as an Eros book, people, when eBay shut it down, "Oh, no, we don't sell those anymore." Okay, so I put it up and just said it's Fantagraphics. Sold. So that was cool. Kathy Keene, Model Behavior. This was a book I picked up. When did this come out? A 2008 Archie book. I don't think this was a reprint of anything other than like some of the older Kathy Keene stuff. Corey, did you ever get up a copy of Low Society?
No.
It was a Cerebus tie-in where this group took advantage of Dave Sims' offer to use Cerebus in any type of comic you wanted, as long as you attributed Cerebus belong to him. And they did that. It's not especially done well, but it was kind of an interesting idea. They did a couple different stories, Morning Stroll, Legacy, Honking Sound of Hand, The Sound of One Hand Honking, Cerebus 700, That Was Then, This Is Now. And they only did one, so it probably didn't sell very well. But I think, Dave Sim didn't sue him because he said, hey, go ahead and do it. Didn't bother him.
Yep, he has released the Cerebus copyright, as it were, to people, which is not the first time that has been done, by the way. There is a character created by a group that is available for anyone to use. It is they call it a public source character named Jenny Everywhere. And while you go on your next eBay thing, I'm going to pull up the information for Jenny Everywhere.
Cool. Speaking of signed, I had a copy of Space Above and Beyond, the official comic adaptation of the hit Fox series, signed by the one and only Roy Thomas, complete with one of those DF certificate of authenticities. What I have noticed is that Dynamic Forces, at one time, they would sell like hundreds of thousands and tens of thousand copies of this, but they've kind of limited now. Old Rascally Roy signed 200 copies of this, and that was back in... I had to be around 1996 because that's when the show came out. Corey, did you ever get a copy of the Essential Ellison?
Yes.
Well, the 35-year copy. I've got the 40-year one, I think the purple one. But I figured, why have both? These are out of print. 1987 came up. There's ones with Ellison's autograph in it that go sky high. I put mine up for $75 and sold it almost immediately. Pre-owned non-smoking jacket. I hope whoever got it enjoys it. And then, of course, there are guys like Eric. Eric is one of our listeners. He thoroughly annoyed me by taking advantage of my generous half-price offer from the last podcast. I'll just read it to you. He said, hey, Joe, I'm a listener of the podcast and would like to purchase three Marvel handbooks, the 60s, 1980s, 1990s, you have listed for half off. Not seeing a way to make an offer using the mobile app, I'll try using the desktop version to see if it'll let me. Thank you, Eric. And I was incensed. I wrote back, Eric, not good enough. Tell you what, you buy one at normal price, I'll toss in the other two for free. Just don't tell Corey. There's only room for one goody two shoes on this here podcast. Thank you for listening. And he said, thank you times a million. The podcast is my top of the pile choice when it comes through each week. And I've been a dedicated listener for years. It's been a fun ride and hope the trip to Hawaii isn't off. Awesome. So thank you, Eric. I'm telling you, if I know you're listening to this podcast, half price just wasn't good enough. And I gave it to him. I gave him a deal. What can I say? I'm crazy. By the time this year podcast, well, let's take a look at the calendar. No, you still got a, yeah, by the time this hits, I'll be getting ready to go to Florida. I'm sorry, Hawaii. I'd be happy to go to Florida too, but I'm going to have IE. But you can always send me a note saying, hey, I'm a listener to this year podcast. Can you cut me a deal on this? It may not be half price. May not be buy one, get two free. But I like to take care of your listeners because I appreciate each and every one of you. And I would love to thank each and every one of you. Thank you, 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 thank you. Corey, did you get the information up yet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Anyways, crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z, come get some.
All right. The world's first public character that was created to be public domain. Jenny Everywhere's creation was a collaborative effort which took place in 2001 and 2002 on the Barbalith Underground Forum, which someday I should talk about. That forum, which started out as a forum about the Invisibles and just became this wonderful community that eventually sort of faded away. I was part of that. It was a very important part of my life. Was created on the Barbalith Underground Forum, where she was initially thought up under the name The Shifter. by her basic look was unveiled on August 13th by Stephen Wintle in a pair of public domain sketches. He spoke at some length about the origins of the character, whom he had originally conceived for a never materialized comic project. She has dimensional powers. To associates, this means she can traverse, say, four or five dimensions, whatever that means. Truth is, she can access all dimensions. Again, not exactly sure what that means, and you can see why it was abandoned. The part I really liked about her was that she inhabited all dimensions at the same time, or to be more accurate, parallel universes. Yes, I was thinking of Crisis on Infinite Earths. Basically, she has an infinite number of adventures on an infinite number of planets. Our story involved her staying on one Earth, but it needn't be the case in this exercise. He then released the character to public domain, which means, now a lot of people say public domain means nobody owns it. No, public domain means we all own it. So anybody doing a comic can use Jenny Everywhere. And over 50 different comics, and mostly web comics, but some in print, have used the character. If you look for Jenny Everywhere, there's some really good web pages that will show everything she has shown up in, including JennyEverywhere.net. She is a public domain character, so if you are doing a comic and want to use her, go ahead. If you're writing a book, go ahead. Movie? Sure. TV series? Whatever. I can't think of any other character that was created to be public domain. Now, I do like that Dave Sim, now that he's done his Cerebus, has said, all right, anybody can use it, just make sure you credit me as the creator. Why? Well, why not? I think that's such a cool idea. It leads us to my favorite part of the show. No, 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 not where I quiz Joe about the Chromium Man. So, Joe, who published The Chromium Man?
Wasn't that Titanium Press or whatever?
Triumphant
Press. I got the T right, but each one was individually serialized, if I recall.
Yep. There was a comic that just came out that was individually serialized, too, but I don't remember what it was. I just saw it at the source last time we were there. No, 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 it's Freaking and Geeking. Joe, what you freaking on?
Oh, I got sick. I don't like getting sick because it burns. My problem is working 10-hour days. I burn 10 hours of sick time. And it just was a case where it was just too much, too fast, not enough time to sleep. You know, I had work till like 12:30 a.m. because there's a late flight that we got to cover. Normally, I'm supposed to start at noons. I'd done two 12-hour days. And then the last one was done by 12:30, but I had to get up at 7:30 because I had to bid for our new shift. Oh, by the way, Corey, I got the same days off, so we don't have to worry about shuffling the podcast back and forth. So
okay. That's
kind of a mini freaking. Then I went to bed and I tried to get a couple hours of sleep. And I figured 2 hours because it take a while to get to bed. You do a 90-minute REM cycle, and if I'm lucky, I wake up right as I'm waking up. But what had happened was I woke up, the alarm went off, and I was in my dead sleep cycle. And I was groggy as you know what, and 2 cups of Mountain Dew caffeine. I got to work. I took a large black iced tea. I just was dragging my butt. And I got home, and I thought, okay, time to go to sleep. Went to sleep at about 10. 1 o'clock, woke up. Ooh, tummy grumbling. Okay. Took care of my tummy grumblings. Half hour later, grumbled again. Half hour after that, grumbled a third time. On and on and on, all the way till 5 a.m. And I finally went to sleep again. And then I got up when I was supposed to get ready for work. And my wife's like, you look bad. You're pale. And I just said, okay, I throw in the towel. I just stayed home. And I hate to stay home because, did I mention last week I found out I have a hernia?
Another one?
Yeah. Well, the last one was in 19, late 1990s when I had the shop.
Yeah, it was when you were at the small shop, and Dave and Jess were still working there, because remember, Jess drew that cartoon of you in a hospital bed. I got a hyena.
Well, it was actually the big shop, because Mike was my employee. Dave was still with us. And I believe Jess was working the other shop, because what had happened is I remember, well, maybe it was a small shop, but I remember Mike was working. And when I finally got up, you know, I'm full of wonderful drugs, and I'm like, let's go say hi to Mike. And I went in and said hi to Mike. As I was there, the painkillers wore off. And Mike just said to me later, he said, I just watched your head drop low.
Yeah, that was the small shop.
Okay, because I went home. And the reason I went in, it was because I had on my left leg, I could barely move my hip. And this was before I knew I had rheumatoid arthritis. Matter of fact, it might have been before it even flared up. So I went in, doctor's like, he's getting in there really deep, pressing against the sore muscles. He says, you know, I don't feel a hernia over there. It might be bursitis, but you got one over here on the right side. Feel that little bump? Yeah, that didn't hurt at all. So anyways, my previous doctor has left the organization he's with. I say left because he didn't get the, we wish you good luck in your future endeavors, and he didn't retire and whatever. He probably just said, you know what, I'm going somewhere better. So the new doctor I went, I said, I think I got a hernia here, because sometimes if I catch a cough wrong, it pops. And he goes, yep, you got a hernia. Got to go get that taken care of. I'm like, but I'm going to Hawaii, and there's like a Comic-Con coming up that I want to go to. And nope. So I've got referrals for that. I got referrals to have my, you know, Corey and I are both over 50. Good time to go in and see a dermatologist to see if you've got skin cancer, because melanoma could be popped up on your back or your butt and you'd never know it. I have friends who, younger than me, who caught it because they had just a strange mark on their body that started festering. I've got an uncle who's fighting it, having chunks taken out of his face because it keeps growing. So yeah, if you're over a certain age and if there's a medical procedure to get done, do it. I'm looking at you guys who haven't had colonoscopies yet. So anyways, that night, after being up all night, I took a muscle relaxant because the next day was my day off. And I was finally able to get to sleep. Although the next day I woke up, I was like in a permanent fuzz for half the day because the muscle relaxant was still there. I mean, I was trying to type messages, and I finally was talking to someone on the phone. I said, I got to quit doing this because I've been trying to write the word stop for like 10 minutes, and I keep missing the P on the keyboard, which is too much. Little things tend to pile up. At the beginning of the year, I never said this as a freaking, but there was a shit ton of little things that just pile up. The things that annoy you, like the windshield wipers aren't working on the car. There's a drip in the tub. There's a squeak in the dryer. The M on my computer fell off, which is weird because I seem to can't hit P right. So if I ever typed you and I mentioned something, it means I missed, the M didn't hit. And being that the thing's only 2 years old, I'm just living with it. But what happened is over time, these little things get solved. Sometimes it's a major thing. Like I went in on Wednesday to get a shower, and the shower wasn't working. I mean, the water was coming out the main part of the pipe, but you know, when you hit that diverter to have the water come up, it would just dribble out. And I'm like, shit, it's broken. Fortunately, we were able to get a plumber in. He found out, although the O-ring had broke, because of the age, you couldn't get the O-ring replaced, so he just replaced the whole thing. So now, much to the appreciation of everybody left in the house, I can go take a shower, which I'll be doing after we finish talking.
Well, it's about damn time.
Hey, well, it's you know, I'm going to Hawaii. Who cares? Finally, the last thing that's annoying me is, again, Discount Comic Book Service. They keep doing things where they will tell me, we are out of a book. It's been shorted. Diamond's not replacing it. Okay, fine. But they tell me this 2 months after the fucking book comes out. which is annoying because when I go to my friendly neighborhood comic store, trying to find that book can be problematic. I lucked out. I've got three I'm missing. And one of them, I don't even know if it came out. The Fantastic Four, Alpha War, whatever it is.
Oh, the Reckoning War.
Yeah. Because I was shorted. I'm not getting my copy. I haven't seen it anywhere. I don't even think they're into it yet because the current – well, they probably are because I looked at the current issue of FF and the Watcher's in it.
Yes. The Reckoning War is on.
So I have no fucking clue where I'm going to get my copy. You know, the worst part is it's always, you know, well, you ordered this variant copy. We got shorted. Well, could you, like, get me another one or do something else? Whatever. Or at least let me cancel the Omega and I'll just buy it as a graphic novel. So I did find House of Slaughter 2, which is great because House of Slaughter 4 just shipped. And then there's a Knights of the Dinner Table that's a couple old. I know Kenzer has them in stock, but whether Diamond ships it or not, I have no clue. I have a couple of those hardcover or those paperback books where they put together, you know, like this is the run of the Bag War that is still on my order form, even though I know it's so they have them. So again, I don't know what's going on with that, but it's annoying. Discount comic book service. Just if you get shorted, let me know now because I don't want to have to, you know, really 2 fucking months later. That is supremely annoying for a comic reader, much less a collector. So that's pretty much what's got my beef going. I suppose in a couple of weeks I'll be complaining I'm sunburned, but that's neither here nor there. Corey, what are you freaking on?
Joe, are you looking to see the new Batman movie?
You know, I wasn't going to because when I saw it before Spider-Man, I was kind of like, But because the reviews seem to be overwhelmingly positive, I'm kind of like, yeah, I think I'll – it's on my list.
Do you want to see it at an AMC theater?
I thought they were bankrupt.
They are, but they're still around. Bankruptcy just means they're protected from their creditors.
Oh, well, I go to Marcus anyways, but not AMC.
That's probably a good thing because AMC is charging more for the Batman movie than any other movie, and they are calling it exclusive pricing. Ooh. And what it is, movies that are more popular, they're going to start charging more money for. And all I could think when I heard that was, wow, AMC really doesn't want me to go see movies there.
Especially not when you've got competition.
Well, you've got competition. You've got, it's going to be on HBO Max in, what, 45 days, I think, is the window. Either 45 or 90 days. And I can see at my own house. And when I go to see a movie in a theater now, it's digitally projected. You know what that means? That means that it's recorded and they're showing it basically in 8K. Well, my home TV is 4K. And really, when you go from 4K to 8K, you don't see that much of a difference. Also, because it's a digital theater, no one is in the projection booth. How do I know that? Because when I worked there, we had two digital projectors. Once we loaded the film onto it, we didn't touch them. Had nothing to do. It was all loaded in to, okay, it starts at this time. And you play it at that time. And there was only one person for the 14 other theaters showing the actual film. And I know people who work at digital theaters. It's like, nope, once we program it all on Thursday night, we only go up there if there's a problem. So if you go to the theater and the sound is a little off or the picture's a little off or there's something not right, you've got to go and complain. And then they send somebody up and they have to figure out what's going on. And that could be, you know, on a good night, that could be 10 minutes. On a bad night, on a busy night, it could be 30 minutes. One of the big things, when you look at box office receipts, you'll see that even with, you know, people are starting to go back to theaters for big movies like Spider-Man and stuff, it's still not as big as it was before the pandemic. And unless it's a huge event like the Spider-Man movie or something like that, people just aren't going. Anything you do to make it so people have a reason to say no, they are going to say no because we have been trained over the last 2 years, it'll be on at home. Our home theater is just as good. Oh, but they have reclining seats. So do I. They serve alcohol. So do I.
So do I.
They've got full Dolby sound. So do I. Oh, and I can pause it when I got to go take a piss because your movie's 3 hours long. And if I drink a soda and a beer, I'm going to have to pee an hour later.
So, never mind.
Second thing, we're on the road to WrestleMania. WrestleMania is a month from now, Joe. I have the days off around WrestleMania so that I can cover stuff for PW Insider. And you know what I'm thinking about WrestleMania? I'm looking at the card and going, I don't give a shit about any of that. Johnny Knoxville has a match at WrestleMania. Johnny Knoxville, who's in his late 40s, has been beat to shit, can walk with a walker on his bad days. He's going to be in the ring at WrestleMania. Oh, and Roman Reigns versus Brock Lesnar in a title unification match, which, if it's not a screwy finish, somebody will get the title the next day on Raw, because there is no way USA is going to go, oh, no, no, it's okay if Fox has the world title. And Fox is not going to go, oh, no, no, it's okay if USA Comcast has the only world title. You know they're going to do something screwy like that, like the last time they unified the titles, and then they, oh, crap, we need a champion on each show. Give Triple H a title. And it's two nights. They have been running discount deals since the week after tickets were announced. Now, if you're a Comcast subscriber, you can buy three and get one free. And I have a feeling that as they get closer to the show and they haven't sold out the stadium for 2 days, it'll be buy one, get one free. Especially when Vince McMahon in an interview today said, we're going to fill that stadium. You know what they do when they say, oh, we're going to fill that stadium? Boy, are the radio stations in Texas going to have a lot of tickets to give away. And then the last thing is a piece of news that broke my heart. Joe, do you remember when the AEW pay-per-view was here and I covered it? What was the question that I asked Tony Khan?
Oh, I thought it was, why didn't they ask the hot English redhead next to me for her number?
She was a blonde.
It's hot.
What was the question I asked Tony Khan?
I you know, I remember you telling me about it.
I asked, will you be doing any deals with any other part of Warner Brothers? And he said, we have put together a deal with DC Comics. That deal is now over. It seems to have fallen apart because AEW never got back to DC Comics. So they were just too busy to get the deal put together. DC is dealing with all sorts of other things now with their new ownership. And, oh, by the way, one last thing that I'm freaking on. DC Comics had a change to how they are doing business now. Everybody has moved out of the building that they were moved into a few years ago. And let's say I am moving out of the new Los Angeles building and moving to the new Los Angeles building. And I want to have an office. Too bad. Nobody has offices. They're moving to what they call the hot desk work model, which means nobody has their own desk. Nobody has their own office. When you come into the office, you use whatever desk is open, which every study has shown people hate. Every study shows people just hate that. Because it makes them feel like everything is temporary, that nothing is permanent, that their job isn't safe, et cetera, et cetera. So, way to go, DC. You've jumped on a business trend from 5 years ago that has already been shown to be horrible for employee morale and retention. Joe, what are you geeking on?
Let's see. Well, as this podcast drops, I'll be going to Hawaii in 4 days. Read a couple books. Actually, I finished a series. I finished Invincible via the Ultimate Collection. What a roller coaster book. I mean, there's times where I just take my time and I read through it, and there's times where I cannot flip the page fast enough. And I took my time doing it because I knew once it was done, it was done. But it was just a lot of fun. I mean, if you ever want to see, I can't envision anybody but Kirkman getting to do a comic this way, because you can't change the status quo of your character. It's like we've talked about the sandbox. Yeah, you can build as big a sandcastle as you want, but you got to level it off for the next guy to come along and play with it. So Invincible is just one of those books that's just phenomenal. If you've never experienced it, find a way to do that. I found my way through the 12 hardcover volumes. There's what, 3-4 compendiums. There's paperback books. Or if you're a glutton for punishment, go out and find the individual issues. But definitely, definitely worth picking up. Another one I picked up, well, I should say got a second copy of, The Department of Truth. Finally read volume 1, The End of the World, which is cool because I got volume 2 waiting to go. I don't really want to give away too much about it, but I'll just read the back cover. Cole Turner has studied conspiracies all his life, from the Flat Earth Theory and the assassination of JFK to modern-day crisis actors. But he isn't prepared to live in a world where collective belief can turn fringe theories into reality. That's the terrible secret revealed to Cole when he is inducted into the Department of Truth, a top-secret branch of the American government that has been tasked for generations making sure dangerous conspiracies don't gain a foothold in the real world. But as Cole pulls back the curtain on everything he ever accepted as fact, he must ask himself whether this mysterious department is a force for good, or if it has more sinister reasons for wanting to control the truth. In my view, that gave away too much. It's much more fun to sit down and read this and discover it on your own. But there's no way someone's just going to read this and discover it on his own. Therefore, you have to give away some of the fun. I do find the only real flaw I have is, okay, you're coming into this. You know, or at least you suspect you know the truth. Cole, though, however, he strikes me as an agent who he's real doubtful still of the truth, a Department of Truth, which is probably what he should be doing. But it's kind of like one of these things like, okay, this is what we got to do. We got to change history back so that, I'm making this up, by the way, so the Nazis lose the war. Yeah, but all these millions of people are going to die. Well, but it changes from billions of people if we don't. You know, that's the choice you have to make. And again, you see these choices. Maybe I've just been reading too many books and seeing too many shows where this is the case. But I'm kind of like, if I was with this department, I'd be like, yeah, I get she's screwed over, but it's just the way it's got to be, you know? So, but it's still, it's a wonderful book. The art is sufficiently creepy enough to keep the story going. And like I said, I bought volume 1, I bought volume 2. I'm going to read it and I'll probably be raving about it later. So that's pretty cool. Now, in a minor freaking, of course, I went yesterday to watch the Paramount Network. That's silly me. I wanted to continue watching Star Trek Discovery. What did I fail to think of, Corey?
That Picard started yesterday?
Yes. And I didn't even realize that until the following day, today, when I realized, oh, that's why I couldn't get it. So, but I got fallbacks. I went to Amazon Prime and watched the second episode of Invincibles 2. And although I know it closely follows the comic, I don't remember what's going to happen. I mean, there may be certain things I remember. Yeah, this might happen, that might happen. But I'm really, really enjoying it. And the other thing that's massively fun about Amazon Prime is you can pause it and up comes the character and the actor, or in this case, the actor's name, voicing it. You know, I did not realize, oh, who's the guy from Allstate? He's doing the voice of Omni-Man.
Oh, that's J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah, good enough. You know what I'm talking about. Or Zachary Quintino was doing Rex, well, as he's now then, Robot. So that was just a lot of fun. You know I'm going to be talking about, I'm so geeking that I've got not only Free Comic Book Day out, but also right after that, the 14th, will be the MCBA's comic book show. I'll talk more about that. Of course, Mermaid Center, I think it's 10 to 5 p.m., $5 off admission. I do believe tables are sold out, but you can always call and ask. And I'll have flyers for it coming up within the next week. So if you want me to send you a personal flyer to remind you, I will. But I did get to go to a couple Comic-Con's toy shows. I didn't really plug them because by the time they hit, the previous podcast had dropped. And, of course, the one that we tried to do just kind of vanished in the ether. So somewhere in the ethernet, you hear me raving about a comic book con that's already done. But I just wanted to geek on some of the things that I bought. At the comic show, I bought a set of the Heroes. What did they call the Heroes Reborn, where Rob Liefeld and Jim Lee took over?
Oh, yeah, that's Heroes Reborn.
Yeah, I was able to pick up the Avengers set, all 12 of them. Actually, I should say all 13. So I was able to get that as well. I picked up.
That is the thing that people seem to be missing. They have the trade paperbacks, what they call the complete collection. It's not complete because it does not have the crossover with the Image characters.
Yeah.
Which was issue 13 of all four of those books.
And I picked up a run of the Shadow War of Hawkman and the corresponding Hawkman series, mostly because it was written by the high priest of the Church of Godzilla, Tony Isabella. I remember buying these as a kid, and I don't have them, so I figured for a buck a piece, I'd pick them up as well. I did pick up.
You were a kid. They came out in 86. You were not a kid.
I was then. I was naive. I was back when I just bought. Besides, at they were 60 cent a piece, and then they jumped to 75, excuse me. The other run I bought, I picked up Iron Man 1 through 12, and then this afternoon when I went to the source, I was able to find Iron Man number 13. So that was kind of fun. That was an actual comic show. I believe TC Collectibles did it, the guys who used to run. I don't think they were the Captain Jack guys. There was another. Did they used to do Blizzard Con? Well, either way, it was a room full of comic dealers. Lots of stuff going on. I mean, guys, I saw somebody buy a very cherry copy of World Finest Comics number 40 with Batman, Superman, and Robin on a fire rig. I didn't ask how much because I'd probably die. I saw a guy picking up a copy of the first Swamp Thing, $175, as I was busy buying my dollar comics. So there was a lot of deals going on. People showing off their collections and the Minnesota Comic Squad things that they pick up. The next day I went to the toy show. Didn't buy as much there. I did buy the Fantastic Four run of World's Finest, or the Heroes Reborn. Again, I didn't have an issue 13, which I need. The funny thing was that both of these, I could not find a run of Captain America. I found like onesie twosies, and I'm like, I'm not getting into a hunt for these things. If they're all there for a buck, I'll pick them up. And I don't even mind buying the 13-ish, the issue number 13 later. The only toy I bought was a They Live figure of the Rowdy one, Roddy Piper. You know, which is weird because it occurred to me, you know, I'll see this thing at Target and probably not buy it. But boy, when I see it at a toy show, it was one of like two things I was going to go for. The other thing, I made an offer to the guy and he got annoyed at me. Because I made the mistake of telling him, well, you know, it's going $20 less on eBay.
How dare you, sir?
How dare you? It's like, well, whatever. I'll go to eBay. I don't care. I'd rather give you my cash. So the next one, I believe, let me, excuse me while I check this out. Let's see, Minnesota Toy Posse. It's going to be, dun, dun, dun. Let's see. By the way, the Minnesota Toy Posse is a private group, but you can always get into it. Just send them a note. March Madness Sale, March 27th. 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's free admission, and this one will be at the Bloomington Event Center, which is, I believe, a VFW. You have to go down American Boulevard because it's actually near the crossroad American Boulevard and 35W, but there's no exit. So you got to go to either France or Nicollet and just work your way back. So, and because it's free admission and it starts at 10 a.m., I can go early, wander through, and still make it to work on time. And let's see. Well, that's it for me geeking. How about you, Corey? What you geeking on?
last night on AEW Dynamite, we had been told that there was going to be a big announcement. Now, the problem is that Tony Khan, the owner of AEW All Elite Wrestling, he pulls out the big announcement way too often, such as when Paul White, the former Big Show, former Giant, the aren't you Andre's kid, showed up.
Huh.
Or when Christian Cage showed up. But this time, he was the one in the ring making the announcement. Joe, you remember a few months ago when I said that Ring of Honor was shutting down for a while?
Yeah.
They have been bought by All Elite Wrestling.
Ooh.
Now, what that means at this point is that he has bought the trademarks, copyrights, and the tape library. As of March 31st, no one is under contract anymore because everybody whose contract would have renewed in the first 6 months of this year, their contract ended with a payoff on 12/31 of last year. Everybody who had a contract that went to the end of this year had a buyout clause for 31st of March this year. They do have a pay-per-view scheduled the week of WrestleMania, but Tony Khan said that he was a person who loved Ring of Honor. He purchased it so that it would still exist. No idea what it means. No idea if it's still going to have the hour-long TV show on Sinclair, where the tape library is going to go, et cetera, et cetera. We will find out more. But from the now that the deal is done, Vince McMahon came sniffing around when Sinclair said that they were having to shut down operations, and he offered he basically lowballed them, and Sinclair said, no, no, no. They were going to restart with a kind of a different way of running the company because their parent company, Sinclair, which is a broadcast company and has run into huge financial problems. Locally here, they own Channel 23. Or is it 29?
No, 29 is affiliated with Channel 9.
Okay, then it's Channel 23.
Yep.
Channel 23. They're running into financial trouble because of corporate stuff. They tried to buy, basically, they tried to buy a bunch of sports networks and it fell apart, costing them a lot of money. But they were going to contract wrestlers through a story. Say you're going to have the Briscoes in a feud with the Authors of Violence. They would contract them for that story. Rather than, okay, we're going to give you a 6-month deal, a 12-month deal, et cetera. It's we're going to contract you for this story. We're going to have you in. We're going to film the matches and the vignettes, and then we'll put them in the show. And other people, they would pay them for per appearances. So let's say you're a Jonathan Gresham and you're the champion, and we're going to have you go against these 6 people over the next 6 months. They would just pay you, all right, we're going to have you come in. You're going to wrestle these 6 matches. We'll give you this much per match. But Tony Khan came in. He has bought them up, and we will be finding out what will happen in the days and weeks to come. But I am glad that it sold to a man who loves wrestling, is putting together good wrestling. And if it were, it's one of those where if I were in charge, let's say I'm Tony Khan, I've just bought Ring of Honor. What I would do is I would make sure that I kept the TV deal with Sinclair so that there's an hour of it every week. I would work and try and syndicate it to non-Sinclair stations and kind of build a syndication thing. You know, hey, local channel, here's some cheap programming. You want to buy it? And then I would put William Regal in charge with Samoa Joe. And their job is, you're to find new talent. Ring of Honor is where they learn the ropes. That's where they learn how to be wrestlers. That way, after they've been in Ring of Honor for a while, and they become polished, and you think they're ready, you call them up to AEW. They've become your developmental territory. Also, Joe, you've got the Netflix. Did you notice that all the Marvel shows left Netflix on February 28th?
I did, and they're going to pop up on Netflix or pop up on Disney under the Marvel imprint.
Yes, on the 16th of this month, they show up on Disney. It will also be, Disney will put in parental controls on that date as well. So if you don't want your little kids to be able to watch Daredevil, which is probably an R-rated show for violence and language, or Alias, which is an R-rated show for violence and language, you can actually set controls. But it's all coming home to Disney Plus. There was some talk about would they go to Hulu or to Disney. Well, looks like they're all going to Disney. Comic-wise, I read Ghost Rider number one. I am not a huge Ghost Rider fan. Ghost Rider is one of those characters I could take or leave. Back in the 70s, I read it because, hey, it's Marvel. But it very quickly became, well, this is kind of where they put people who are under contract but aren't that good. I'm not going to name names, except for Michael Fleischer, because he's no longer with us. But, yeah, it was, okay, yeah, this book is still selling, but we don't much care for it, and you aren't that great. So here you go. Knock yourself out. but Ghost Rider number one, the new one, blew my mind at how good it was. And when we were doing the previews of it, I said, that cover is amazing. Now, it's not the same artist doing the cover that did the interior, but the interior is super cool. It has a great twist, and I'm so excited as to where they're going with it. And it is the return of Johnny Blaze. It is not the Ghost Rider in the Avengers. Johnny Blaze is in it. You see the new Ghost Rider? I'm not telling, I'm not telling. You need to read it because it kicks ass. And the last thing I am geeking on, we are now 3 issues into the Reckoning War, which Dan Slott started teasing back in, what was it, 2006? During his run on She-Hulk? Joe, you haven't read any of it, right?
Probably ain't going to read the Alpha, unfortunately, but I do have the rest of it on order.
Here's the thing about the Reckoning War. Dan Slott has always said that this is a plot thread from way back in the 60s that no one picked up on. And when he lets you know what the Reckoning War is and why it is, you're going to go, I can't believe nobody ever picked up on that. That is genius. It's so very good. It is so very good. It's going to be lasting a long time because I think they're, what, 3 issues in, and they're still soliciting it in the next previews. So it's not crossing over into everything, which I think is good. I think there are some tie-ins here and there. My only problem is, like every other big event at Marvel, aliens are invading. Oh, can we please stop? Can we please stop having aliens invade? If I were at Marvel right now, this is another if I were in charge. If I were in charge of Marvel right now, I would tell all the editors, no aliens can invade Earth for 5 years.
No.
We've had too many alien invasions. And that's what I'm geeking on. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books and pretty much only funny books for an hour and a half.
Well, we'll try to do better next time.
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most. Joe?
Corey, when does a joke become a dad joke?
I don't know, Joe. When does a joke become a dad joke?
When it becomes a parent. Ugh. Hit my music.
When are you going to Hawaii?
down, bitches!